The first radio broadcast of Democracy Now! From the studios of WPFW in Washington, D.C. Now we broadcast on over 1,300 television and radio stations across the globe and reach millions of viewers and listeners through our website at democracynow.org. Go to our website to listen to our first program that aired the day before the 1996 New Hampshire primary. Thanks so much to our staff, our stations, and our audience for making Democracy Now! Possible. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltzer, Mate Nermin Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Malkoff, Honey Massoud, Rabbi Karen, Dina Gester, Amy Littlefield. I'm Amy Goodman. Special thanks to Julie Crosby.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. Next up is the evening news.
Tune in Thursdays from 6 to 7 p.m. to hear Rose City Native Radio with your host, Jackie Malmstrom. Rose City Native Radio is a new public affairs program bringing you local and national Native issues and Native contemporary music. You can find more information about the show online at kboo.fm or find us on Facebook at Rose City Native Radio.
KBOO Community Radio and Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights are proud to sponsor a panel discussion called Occupation, Environmental Destruction, and the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, a panel discussion on international resistance this Tuesday, February 24th at the PSU Smith Center Ballroom. This panel will feature the Portland appearance of Palestinian intellectual and activist Omar Barghouti, as well as Kanahus Manuel, mother of four and First Nations anti-mining activists from British Columbia, Cecily Saraski, Communications Director of Jewish Voice for Peace, and Dr. Michael Yellowbird, Professor of Sociology and Anthropology and Director of Indigenous Peoples Studies at North Dakota State University. That's Occupation, Environmental Destruction, and the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, a panel discussion on international resistance, February 24th at PSU's Smith Center Ballroom, 1825 Southwest Broadway in Portland. More information on the KBOO webpage on the right side under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Saturday Market, From Our Hands to Yours, celebrating 42 years of American arts and crafts, freshly prepared foods with an international flavor, and local music every Saturday and Sunday from February 28th through Christmas Eve. Local artisans, international food, live music. PortlandSaturdayMarket.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Portland City Council votes to be a part of the Joint Terrorism Task Force.
A new report based on documents released by Edward Snowden show the NSA hacked into cell phones around the world.
And Kate Brown's first action as governor of Oregon is to call for an end to the West Coast port standoff between union workers and port management.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, February 19th, 2015. I'm Eric Tegedoff.
And I'm Sarika Mehta. The Portland City Council today voted to rejoin the Joint Terrorism Task Force with a vote of 3 in favor and 2 against. The 2 dissenting votes were Commissioners Amanda Fritz and Steve Novick. The JTTF creates a local agency to coordinate data, information, and surveillance between local, state, and federal law enforcement officials coordinated by the FBI. The vote followed a hearing last week in which 4 hours of public testimony focused on the many problems presented by the task force. The testimony was overwhelmingly opposed to the city joining the JTTF, with many people citing the numerous civil liberties violations, targeting of Muslims, and profiling of minorities that the JTTF stands accused of in cities across the country. In Portland, KBOO reporter Linda Olson Osterlund exposed the fact that the JTTF went behind the backs of city officials to establish a quote-unquote fusion center on the campus of Clackamas Community College, even when the city had not signed on to participate in the task force. Despite the record of the GTTF across the country and the widespread local opposition, three city officials, including Mayor Hales, decided that it is in Portland's best interest to join the Joint Terrorism Task Force. Here's Mayor Hales, followed by Commissioners Fritz and Novick.
There's strong feelings on both sides of this issue and in my own heart and my own mind. There are two words that I think my dilemma about this issue revolved around. One is ashamed, and the other is appalled. I'm ashamed as an American that we have been involved in wars without justification, in prisons without trials, and in torture. I hate to even say those words. I have not too much trouble making decisions in this job, but sometimes I'm up late at night, and lately when I've been up late at night, I've been watching Ken Burns' series about World War II. And the moral clarity that we as a country had at the end of that war contrasts so appallingly, again, that word, with what we have done lately in the world, that it makes it very difficult for me to contemplate cooperating with the federal government, because I think much of what has been done, unfortunately, in the last several administrations, has cost us moral authority in the world and violates principles that I really believe in as an American. So I am ashamed. And many federal agencies have been complicit in those wrongs, including the FBI. The other word is appalled. And I'm appalled by the radical evil that is loose in the world today. I'm appalled at what has happened to innocent people. We were all appalled on September 11th when our country was attacked. And that was an attack by terrorists on symbols of American power that murdered a lot of innocent people. Maybe there were some of us here in Portland who could have thought then, well, that was an attack on the symbols of American power. It may not affect us here in Portland. But most recently, the attacks in Paris and Copenhagen and Boston are incidents in which people, we call them terrorists, attacked their own communities and murdered their neighbors. And I think any conceit that we might be exempt from that radical evil here is unfortunately removed by what happened in those places.
We had an opportunity here today to create more confidence within our community. I don't believe with this action that we are doing that. Everyone here on this council and everybody here in this chamber is committed to public safety here in our city. The question is, how do we best get there? Casey Jama of the Center for Intercultural Organizing said at the hearing, we could pursue a different strategy, one that relies on the community rather than suspecting the community. He talks to the Somali youth that he works with and said the way to win hearts and minds is not targeting them and making them feel like they are suspects. I grew up in England during the IRA bombings. So that was back in the 60s and 70s, long before people in this country felt unsafe going to a grocery store or a pub or a place of travel. I was in Europe the summer of 2001 and was really pleased to see the dog sniffing guns at the airport in Paris, found the little metal statue that my son had in his carry-on suitcase, and were able to dig out the little mannequin pee and find out that, in fact, it was a little statue and not a gun. And I was very used to, in railway stations, looking around to see were there any unattached belongings, because I had a friend in grade school whose brother was killed by the IRA in Ireland, and we had the center of Manchester blown up. And it's Manchester's about the same distance as Salem is from here to my hometown. And yet we relied on community to make sure that when people were about to do bad things that we found out about it. And there were a number of terrorist activities which were dissuaded because people could trust the police to be working to keep everybody safe. We have a lot of trust issues. And to me, that's the most urgent need that we have here. Yes, there are threats from terrorism. There are also threats from our community members not being able to trust us, the elected officials, and not being able to trust their government. So no, I don't support this.
I want to reiterate that this has been a very difficult decision for me, and I've been reading letters and making phone calls up to today. A couple of hours ago, I had a conversation with Laura Dugan, who's a criminology professor at the University of Maryland, a former colleague of my wife's, who's also a member of the National Center for the Study of Terrorism and the Response to Terrorism. And she said that other things being equal, she would recommend being part of the JTTF. When I told her about the opinions of a significant segment of the Muslim community, she said, well, the community relationships are critically important. Although she did say, and I should repeat here, that even if we're not in the JTTF, we could participate in disaster preparedness exercises with the FBI, which she said that the fact that the Boston police had done that repeatedly in Boston was made a big difference in the aftermath of the Boston Marathon bombing. So I think that this is an extremely difficult decision. I really appreciate what the mayor said about how he intends the city to operate. If we join the JTTF, I respectfully vote nay.
That was Portland City Commissioner Steve Novick. Before him was Amanda Fritz and Mayor Charlie Hales. The City Council will accept public testimony that is submitted in writing before next week when they vote on the details of the relationship between the city and the Joint Terrorism Task Force. KBOO's Janka Soderberg spoke with Sophia, a member of Portland's Muslim community, who said she was extremely disappointed with today's vote.
What do you feel that the Joint Terrorism Task Force, what impact would that have on Portland's Muslim community?
I think that it's going to increase the surveillance. It's going to allow police and the FBI to target Muslims, and not just Muslims, but anybody that looks like a Muslim, or and justify that in a way of whatever way that they want to criminalize somebody. So, yeah, that's about it. Like, I think that it's just going to be worse on Muslims in general.
What is the situation in Portland? Does it feel that there is hostility towards the Muslim community here?
It's hard. Like, you don't know who is going to attack you. Like, if you were just walking down the street, somebody could just come up and hit you upside the head and you can just knock out. Like, I saw one of those videos recently where this woman was just walking down the street, minding her own business, got smacked in the back of the head, fell to the ground, and that was it. Like, the guy ran away. Like, that could happen anywhere. That could happen to anybody. And I think especially with Muslim women, it's really hard to not think that, to not think that something could happen to you with all of this going on. Like, there's like things going on in the Muslim community where mosques are being attacked, kids are being attacked, you know, like the three kids or the three students that were killed in their houses. Like, that's not okay. But City Council didn't say one word about it, but they talked about all of these other terrorist attacks that happened by Muslims. And that's one of my problems with this whole JTTF, is that why is it just targeting towards Muslim? Because Muslims are the only one that are identified as, like, terrorist or terrorism. Like, that's not used for any other person that does any crime at all. One of my friends was actually pregnant, and we were talking about how this is her first baby, and we were really excited. And I was talking to her, what are you going to name your child? You know, like, that's really an exciting part of, like, having a child. And she goes to me that she does not want to name her child with any Arabic name, anything that represents somehow Muslims, because she doesn't want her child to be another way of being discriminated against, because her child is going to be Black, Native American, Mexican, and then Muslim. So she just said, I don't want another reason for my child to be attacked in any way.
Well, thank you for joining us. Again, I've been speaking with Sophia, a local activist here in Portland. This is Janka Soderberg with KBOO News.
An explosion at an ExxonMobil oil refinery in Torrance, California, injured four people on Wednesday morning. The explosion sent flames into the air, rattled nearby houses, broke windows, and caused 14 schools to force students to remain indoors. The blast itself was measured at a 1.4 on the Richter scale, but the plant is so large that despite the explosion, most of the facility continued operating it as usual. Torrance is located in the South Bay area of Los Angeles County, which is home to several massive oil refineries. The area has a history of refinery accidents, some of them deadly, including two explosions at the same one in Torrance in 1988 and 1994. Despite the social and political backlash that follows these events and the consistent outcry against pollution from the day-to-day operations of the facilities, little progress has been made in creating effective pollution and safety standards for refineries. Part of the problem is that nearby Port of Los Angeles, which ships in most of the oil refined by the plants, produces so much pollution itself that it siphons off much of the attention and energy of air quality activists. Not to mention that the port, in combination with the neighboring port of Long Beach, is one of the largest ports in the world and a primary driver of Southern California's economy. Thus, any legislation that curbs the port's activities is destined for an uphill battle.
The governors of California, Oregon, and Washington have called for an end to the lengthy West Coast port shutdown and for a comprehensive and fair contract to be reached between the labor unions and shipping companies involved. Newly sworn in Oregon Governor Kate Brown joined Washington Governor Jay Inslee and California Governor Jerry Brown in saying that the port shutdown is slowing down local economies. The International Longshore and Warehouse Union, which represents 20,000 dock workers whose contract ran out in July, has been in negotiations with the Pacific Maritime Association for over 2 years with little progress. President Obama sent his Secretary of Labor, Thomas Perez, to aid in the negotiations, and sources close to the talks say a financial agreement is not far off.
A Washington County judge ruled last Thursday that no crime occurred when 61-year-old Patrick Buono bent down in the aisle of a Target department store and used his phone to snap a photo of a 13-year-old girl's skirt. The voyeuristic phenomenon, known as upskirting, is technically legal in most circumstances in Oregon, as well as many other states, but Oregon legislators are seeking to amend that. Buono was charged with two counts of invasion of privacy and two counts of encouraging child sex abuse in the second degree, but all were thrown out after the judge begrudgingly admitted that the circumstances of the incident weren't illegal. Under Oregon law, clandestine photographs are illegal within bathrooms, locker rooms, tanning booths, and dressing rooms, but the aisles of Target was neither private, nor was the photograph of the girl nude, which is necessary for a conviction under the current privacy law. House Bill 2596, which is sponsored by State Representative Peter Buckley and Andy Olson, would adjust the state's privacy laws to include language that describes upskirting and makes no discrepancy between whether the victim was wearing underwear or not. Additionally, the bill would raise the crime from a misdemeanor to a felony if the victim were under 18. A hearing is scheduled for later this month.
A bill that is under consideration right now in the Oregon State Legislature would regulate their laser cosmetic industry. The lasers in question are used for skin resurfacing, photo rejuvenation, vein reduction, acne, and tattoo removal. Currently, the industry is almost completely unregulated. As a result, people who testified at the hearing in Salem gave examples of skin burning and other injuries caused by people operating lasers for cosmetic procedures. Dozens of Oregon estheticians offered their support for House Bill 2642, which would establish a board of certified laser estheticians to oversee training and licensing of cosmetic laser operators. The new board, operating under the Oregon Health Licensing Agency, would certify people to use lasers in procedures that do not involve breaking the surface of the skin.
Former student Jorge Guzman filed a $187,000 lawsuit this week against an adjunct professor at Portland State University. Guzman claimed Professor Wilson Zare stole his idea for an eco-friendly surfboard company, which aimed to sell balsa wood surfboards rather than synthetically made boards. Guzman also claims he and two other partners brought sample boards to surf shops on the West Coast before Professor Zare became involved. Then, while he was taking an undergraduate course taught by the professor, Guzman says Zare was so interested in the company that he proposed a 50-50 partnership. The suit alleges that Guzman signed an agreement to sell his assets for a price he believed was too low because he believed his class grade would be affected if he did not. Zare eventually left the company without compensating Guzman and his two partners. The former professor began selling identical products to those developed by Guzman and was even selling them from the former company's website. In an email to the Oregonian, Zare said that his company, Yana Surf, was uniquely developed by him and his team, and that Guzman turned down a, quote, significant equity position in the new company. ¶¶
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Adam Weissman of Trade Justice, who is organizing a protest at the New York home of Oregon Senator Ron Wyden tomorrow. The protest is calling on Wyden to oppose the fast-tracking of a secretive trade agreement called the Trans-Pacific Partnership. This will be followed by Rose City Native Radio at 6. At 7, it's Ear to the Streets of Portland with part 2 of a series called Inspiring Youth to Bring Change for the Greater Good, featuring local revolutionary organizer and author Ajamu Umi. Tomorrow's weather is expected to be overcast and chilly with a high of 52 and a low of 38. Today in history, in 1861, serfdom was abolished in Russia by Tsar Alexander II, granting full citizenship to 23 million people. And in 1878, Thomas Edison patented the phonograph, the first machine able to both record and reproduce sound. And a very happy birthday to Nicholas Copernicus, born in 1473, the Polish astronomer and mathematician who proposed that the Earth revolves around the sun, rather than vice versa. And the quote of the day is from Austrian painter and architect, Friedrich Hundertwasser. Everyone should be able to build, and as long as this freedom to build does not exist, the present-day planned architecture cannot be considered art at all.
A new survey conducted by the National Science Foundation discovered that one in every four Americans believes the sun revolves around the Earth. Happy birthday, Copernicus. The study was conducted in 2012, but was released a few days ago at the annual meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science in Chicago. The survey was intended to ascertain basic levels of science education in everyday Americans and was a 9-question true or false survey administered to 2,200 people. Only 48% of those surveyed answered that humans evolved from other animals. The average score was 6.5 correct answers out of 9. Despite the surprising scores, 90% of Americans expressed wide interest and respect for science and scientists, especially new discoveries in the medical sciences.
It is 5:21 and time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
The people of Chicago are presently grappling with a big question that nearly every urban place faces. Can anyone really govern such a sprawling, brawling city? Reclaim Chicago, an upstart populist coalition that has become a major force in the city, says the answer is a great big no. Moreover, asserts this grassroots group, no one should. Rather, the many should, and if they're organized through a democratic network, the people can be their own government, producing egalitarian policies that improve the lives of everyone, advancing the whole city. Indeed, the problem in Chicago has been that one has been in charge, imposing corporate rule that further enriches the rich while holding down everyone else. At present, the city's numero uno is Mayor Rahm Emanuel. The Wall Street Democrat, who uses everything from privatization schemes and tax favoritism to harsh budget cuts and arbitrary police action to shift money and power away from the people and the common good into the coffers of the moneyed elites. Plutocratic ruthlessness aside, however, Mayor 1%, as the people have dubbed him, thinks he's untouchable. Reclaim Chicago, however, is about to test that. This independent coalition is backing a top-notch slate of 14 people's candidates to challenge incumbent city council members who've been tail-wagging lapdogs for Emanuel's corporate rule. And Mayor 1% himself has drawn 2 opponents for the February 24th election. This is Jim Hightower saying, of course, Emanuel is floating on a boatload of special interest cash. But Reclaim Chicago has hundreds of its seasoned and trained members holding personal door-to-door conversations with Chicagoans. Win or lose in this go-round, Reclaim will keep moving onward and upward, and that's exactly what it takes to build a winning people's movement.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out at hightowerlowdown.org.
As reported last night on the KBOO Evening News, the Portland City Council yesterday voted unanimously to raise the wage of certain workers employed by the city. A new national report verifies the council's assertion that the wage gap across the country has vastly increased over the last several decades, and a $15 an hour minimum wage is a necessary stopgap to address the growing divide. Labor justice advocate Lori King testified before Portland City Council about the lengthy and still growing trend of wages that can't keep pace with the cost of living during the fair wage policy hearing Wednesday.
In the last 40 years, we've been living in a time where the power of the corporate elites has grown rapidly, and we're seeing new generations of workers, especially young people of color, just not able to make it, not able to afford to have a family, to have health care, to go to school, even to just get by.
A new brief from Raising America's Pay, a project launched last summer by the Economic Policy Institute, issued published this morning, seems to validate and verify her contentions. KABU reporter Robin Ryan spoke with a representative of the Economic Policy Institute about the report's key findings.
I'm talking with Elise Gould. She is a senior economist with the Economic Policy Institute. And we're going to talk about a briefing that was released today as part of the Raising America's Pay project. Can you tell me when and why the project was launched?
Sure. We are trying to highlight the importance of raising wages to improve the vast majority of Americans' living standards. Most Americans depend on wages as their primary source of income, and as wages have stagnated for so many years, it's important to think about ways in which we can increase America's pay and therefore increase the standard of living that Americans live with.
The first report that I saw was dated from last June. It was about 76 pages long. How often do these briefings come out?
Well, we did launch the project then when that initial document came out, and we've put out a number of papers since then. The paper that came out today was looking at the most recent trends in wages up through 2014.
What did you find for this most recent briefing was the biggest surprise?
Well, we were looking at wages and what happened with real wage growth, inflation-adjusted wage growth between 2013 and 2014, and we find that hourly wages or stagnated or fell across the wage distribution with one exception.
And that exception is?
Unlike the rest of the wage distribution, wages actually increased at the 10th percentile between 2013 and 2014. And the answer is simple as to why this happened. We have some labor standards that provide wage protections. More specifically, 18 states, which make up about 57% of the workforce, increased their minimum wage in 2014.
Are those states well represented in this jump?
Yes. So if we compare states with and without a minimum wage increase, we find clear evidence that the minimum wage is the reason the 10th percentile wage didn't see the negative trends found elsewhere and actually saw a positive trend in the last year. So wages in the 10th percentile rose by 1.6% in states with minimum wage increases, while in states without such an increase, they pretty much stagnated, increasing by a scant 0.3%. So it's a very positive story that we see that these minimum wage increases that happened in 18 states in 2014 actually had a real impact on wages of low-wage workers.
Looking at the reports, I noticed one of them, the key findings listed that from 1979 to 2013, productivity had grown 65% while wages grew at 1/8 of the pace. What do you see as the most apparent impact of such a divide?
You're absolutely right. I mean, we have seen really dismal wage growth for most Americans, and that has happened since 1979, despite real GDP growth of 149% and net productivity growth of about 64-65% over this period. We're talking about 1979 all the way up to 2014. We have seen wages pretty much stagnating and not growing anywhere near their productivity of their work. So workers have become more productive, but we're not seeing that increased productivity in workers' paychecks. And really, that divergence between pay and productivity is at the root of stagnant wage growth, slow family income growth, rising wage of income inequality, and we have not seen an eradication of poverty in this country, and that is partially due to the fact that we are seeing this growing wage inequality, growing income inequality.
The other thing I found kind of interesting about this most recent report, if I'm recalling correctly, is the impact on workers with advanced educations.
That's right. if we look at the top of the wage distribution, those with the most education and the highest wages, we're seeing wages decline in the last year. So over the last year, real wages at the top of the wages distribution fell by 0.7% at the 90th percentile and 1.0% at the 95th percentile. And real wages fell for workers with a four-year college degree, a drop of 1.3%, and even more for those workers with an advanced degree, a decline of 2.2%. One thing I should note, though, is that these data that we have in this release for 2014 do not include what's happening within the top 5%. The data are top-coded such that we can't look at what's happened with the top 1% or the top 0.1%, where there's been a lot of attention of growing wage inequality and growing income inequality. So we can't look at the concentration there. But what is clear is that these workers at the top of the wage distribution, at the top of the education ladder, are facing a labor market such that their wages are not growing and, in fact, are falling at a decent clip.
I've been talking with Elise Gould from the Economic Policy Institute. You can get more information by visiting their website at epi.org. I'm Robin Ryan, and you're listening to KBOO News.
Walmart has announced plans to raise the wages of its workers at all levels of employment, as well as implement greater job mobility strategies. The corporation, which, as the nation's largest private employer, provides jobs to 1.4 million Americans, says it will spend $1 billion to increase the minimum wage to at least $9 for 2015, with an additional increase to $10 in 2016. This increase would largely affect only the company's lowest paid workers, while the hourly wage for full-time employees would increase 15 cents to $12 and 85 cents to $13. Other employee positions would see similarly small wage hikes across the board. There would also be investment in an employee training program that would help workers chart career advancement at the company, as well as allow them to set their own hours. The new investment in their workforce is seen as a response to the growing war of talent amongst large retailers, which has produced wage hikes in an effort to attract more skilled customer service employees. Labor groups grudgingly praised Walmart's move, saying it is long past due and that more progress is needed for Walmart employees to be able to support themselves and their families. The announcement comes amid a general movement towards a higher federal minimum wage and a significant minimum wage increase in some states and cities.
And now let's hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The American Postal Workers Union starts talks on a new contract with the U.S. Postal Service today, with actor-activist Danny Glover in their corner. These postal labor talks come as management is carrying out a policy of slashing jobs, closing mail facilities, and dismantling the vast postal network with piecemeal privatization. Danny Glover's parents were postal workers.
The post office has given people the opportunity to create a middle-class existence. It has allowed them to prosper. It has allowed them to send their children to college, to buy homes. That's what the post office has done. The post office is one of the leading and perhaps the largest employer within that federal system that has allowed them to do that. There's an attempt now to take that away from us. It's an attempt to now remove that from possibilities, and that's what is happening right now.
Glover is motivated to stand with postal workers and other unions because he grew up in a union household where he learned to honor labor and human rights. Glover says workers asserting their rights today are part of an historic human rights struggle, a narrative that also includes the rich and powerful relentlessly trying to crush those movements.
And the narrative has always been, whether it's the Magna Carta, whether it's the fight for the Bill of Rights, is to disenfranchise people, to bring them to the lowest level they can in terms of livelihood, in terms of maintaining themselves. That's been the drama. And to allow the wealth to accumulate in the hands of just a few. Now, Dr. King always talked about a union. He said the best anti-poverty program he knew was the union.
The Teamsters Wednesday announced the formation of a rapid response team to help port truckers get unemployment compensation if West Coast ports are closed by either a lockout or a strike. Teamsters Port Driver Campaign Director Nick Weiner says thousands of port truckers are misclassified as independent contractors instead of employees, making it harder for them to get unemployment compensation.
We've been heartened that over the past several months, we've been able to help some port truck drivers who have been told they were independent contractors qualify and receive unemployment benefits. State officials can't predetermine every individual case, but from our perspective, the situation of port drivers are virtually identical from company to company. So we're confident that they will be able to qualify. It's just helping them through the process.
The ILWU has been attempting to get a new labor contract for 20,000 West Coast dock workers since the current one expired last summer. The Pacific Maritime Association has locked out dock workers from loading and unloading ships sporadically for a few days at a time, even as the labor talks continue.
Workers Independent News is brought to you by the American Federation of Teachers and its 1.6 million members working to reclaim the promise of public education, health care, and public services for our students, their families, and our communities. More information online at aft.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders publicly announced that he is considering a presidential run in 2016, which was announced during a speech at the Brookings Institute. The independent senator from Vermont is widely known as the most effective progressive within Congress and has worked consistently to combat wealth inequality and the influence of money in American politics. His views on economic policy would position him significantly to the left of presidential hopeful Hillary Clinton. Sanders specifically proposed that he would prioritize climate change, universal health care, taxing financial transactions on Wall Street, and cutting all public college tuition in half. He acknowledged that in order to take on the powerful political clout of corporate families such as the Koch brothers, his campaign would have to organize the largest grassroots movement that has been seen in modern history. It is unclear whether he would attempt to run as an independent and risk splitting liberal voters, or enter into the Democratic primary. The senator made it very explicit that he firmly believes the greatest threat to our democracy is the extreme imbalance of wealth and the influence that those wealthy minorities hold over the political process.
The National Security Agency, or NSA, helped Britain's electronic spying agency steal phone codes from a Dutch company that makes SIM cards. According to documents given to journalists by Edward Snowden, the NSA and their British allies hacked into the network of Dutch company Gemalto in order to steal the phone codes. Gemalto is the world's biggest maker of SIMs, which are used in cell phones and credit cards. The company's clients include AT&T, T-Mobile, Sprint, and Verizon, according to the website The Intercept, which leaked the security breach on Thursday. Information stealing by the NSA from law-abiding companies like Gemalto breaks the hacking and espionage laws of other countries. The stolen phone codes are yet another example of the NSA's, quote, extra-legal techniques, as the agency has deemed them.
The U.S. and Turkey have agreed to train and equip moderate Syrian rebels in order to better combat the so-called Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, known by its Arabic acronym, Daesh. The U.S. will send 400 troops to the region to host training camps outside of Syria, a part of a larger plan to train 5,000 Syrian rebels per year for 3 years. Saudi Arabia and Turkey have also offered to establish training camps. U.S. and Turkish officials say that they hope that bolstering the ranks of supposedly moderate Syrian rebels will also help defeat Bashar al-Assad's regime in Syria. The Assad government has won successive victories against the rebels in that country's ongoing civil war.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Thursday, February 19th, 2015. Palestinian fighter reported killed in Gaza and Israeli settlers attack leave a Palestinian man injured. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. A Palestinian fighter with Al-Qassam Brigades, the armed wing of Hamas, was announced dead on Thursday afternoon, Palestinian media reported. The brigades said in a press statement that Muhammad Abu Matar, 25, was killed in what the group called it a jihadist mission in Rafah City, southern Gaza Strip. Medical sources said that Matar was killed in an accident inside a tunnel at the Gaza-Egypt borders and gave no further details. Elsewhere, Israeli settlers attacked on Thursday evening a Palestinian man from Yatta village near the southern West Bank city of Hebron. Jibril Nu'man, 55, sustained light wounds due to the settlers' attack and was moved to a local hospital in Hebron City for treatment. Doctors said that Nu'man sustained moderate wounds. Witnesses said that Nu'man was working in his land when he was attacked by Israeli settlers coming from the illegal Israeli settlement in Yatta. Palestinian shepherds and farmers in Yatta and nearby villages are daily target of Israeli settlers illegally living in the area, local sources reported. Earlier on Thursday at dawn, Israeli soldiers kidnapped 11 Palestinians from different parts of the occupied West Bank after breaking into their homes and searching them. Media sources said that soldiers invaded neighborhoods in Nablus City in the northern part of the occupied West Bank, in addition to Zawata town and the Balata refugee camp, and kidnapped 3 Palestinians after searching and ransacking their homes. Furthermore, soldiers kidnapped 6 Palestinians in the northern West Bank district of Tul Karim and 2 in the southern West Bank district of Hebron. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Thursday, February 19th, 2015 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Robin Ryan, Eric Tegedoff, and Ethan Martin. The producer is Sam Bowman. A very happy birthday to our engineer, Matthew Olson. The KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews or look for us on Twitter at KABU News. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Sari Gametta.
And I'm Eric Tegedoff. Coming up tomorrow morning on KABU, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Positively Revolting with Ani and Lynn, welcome Tori Abernathy, art worker, activist, and organizer of the first Portland Renters Assembly, and Nick Caleb, former city council candidate and professor of government. At 9, on Veterans Voice, host Angie and Marvin interview Jeremy Lucier and Mike Walgrave about their transition from the military to being farmers. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Dennis Bernstein hosts Flashpoints, investigative news radio. At 8:11, hosts Paul Roland speaks with author and activist Jerry Mander about corporations, capitalism, and the movement for a new economy. And at 11:30, Jenka Soderberg speaks with the organizers of an event next week on Indigenous people's struggles in the U.S. and Palestine. Hey, thanks to all you KABU members for your generous support. If you are not a current member, you can become one by going to kabu.fm and clicking on Donate Today. And stay tuned now for an interview with a New York activist organizing a protest at Senator Ron Wyden's house in New York about his move to support the fast-tracking of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement.
KABU News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
We are joined on the line now by Adam Weissman, who is with Trade Justice New York. Adam, could you tell us about the protest that's taking place tomorrow at Senator Wyden's home in New York?
Yes. Well, we have been very distressed to learn that Senator Wyden has apparently decided to sell out his constituents, the country, and his fellow Democrats by supporting fast-track legislation. Senator Wyden had in the past said that he would only support a model of fast-track that was more transparent and significantly different than what we've seen before. It looks like now he is going in the direction of joining with Orrin Hatch, the Senate Finance Chair, and other Republicans in handing President Obama fast-track powers, which will facilitate pushing through destructive trade agreements like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, and the Trade and Services Agreement without Congress maintaining its power to adequately and carefully review and, if necessary, make changes to these agreements. So Senator Wyden is really shirking his responsibility to his constituents and to the country here if he goes ahead and supports Fast Track. So we're using this as one last opportunity to send a message to the senator that he shouldn't do this, that he should maintain his responsibility and ensure that Congress has a strong role in defining what our country's trade agreements like, and that we don't pass more job-killing NAFTA-style trade agreements without Congress intervening and making sure that U.S. trade policy actually works for the people of this country and does not undermine the future of our planet by attacking our environment.
Wow. And what's the timeline on this fast track? Is there a vote coming up in the near future?
From what we've heard, fast track legislation is likely to be introduced this coming week. Thereafter, a vote could be imminent. We don't have a clear date on when that'll be, but it looks like it could be quite soon. It's absolutely critical for people to call our senators and our representatives and send a message that they're against fast track, and for Senator